session number 23438, Reel 2.
Shura Shiwag, Reel 2. Okay. So there you are at Sheiko.
Sheiko, and we saw Japanese in the distance. We saw Japanese warships, and there were areas on the island, and we were just billeted there for 2 days, or 2.5 days, and I suddenly realized what a crappy organization British military in the colonies was. Singapore was an utter disgrace, the fall of Singapore. Hong Kong was a bit better, but in those 2 days, we had our only meals. For the next 16 days of fighting, the army fights on its stomach, as Napoleon said, we were never fed once. Nobody. The quartermaster organization just disintegrated. And the man who cooked our food for 2 days was a total idiot, whose job in the colony was with a firm called the Dairy Farm, where he used to mix the soft drinks on an industrial scale. And I remember having my first meat consisted of stewed beef, and I never had heartburn in my life. I suddenly got violent heartburn. I didn't even know what it was. I felt terribly, terribly ill. And these were the last meals we had, because subsequently in the fighting we had to forage for ourselves. There was no water, because most of the water in the hurricane drains was polluted with corpses. So we fought completely on our own, without any help, aid, or support. The support services were non-existent. The quartermasters vanished. I don't know about the regular troops, but I don't think I had a single square meal. I foraged. I once found some cornflakes in the kitchen. The days went without food. And it's very difficult to fight in the mountains, in the hills. So anyhow, the Japanese had landed somewhere in the island, or landing, and we were given the order to retreat towards Repulse Bay, which is a beautiful bay in Hong Kong, with a very famous hotel called the Repulse Bay Hotel. And it was really a flight. We ran with our weapons, and the Japanese were strafing us from the air. There were quite a few casualties. And I noticed that some of our troops put their, but we had no anti-aircraft, put their Vickers machine guns on anti-aircraft mountings. They were firing the Vickers machine guns on these low-flying Japanese planes. But eventually our unit got there without casualties, and we took up positions in the hurricane drains in the hills, and that's when the fighting actually started.
What did it consist of for you personally?
Well, we were looking at down on the Repulse Bay Hotel, which is a very posh hotel, and at one point half the hotel was occupied by the British troops and residents, and half the hotel was occupied by the Japanese. There was fighting going on, people were lobbing grenades to doors, but we were in the hills above. So we fought there, and then when the Japanese occupied the hotel, we went down towards Stanley Village, which was a site of a civilian internment camp afterwards. And there were skirmishes, and we sent our units into the hills. The Japanese were very nearby, and I remember distinguishing myself by firing 4 shots out of a .45 revolver at one of our own men in the dark, and missing 4 times, so that's good. But and then the real battle we got involved in was in Stanley Village. That was very close contact fighting. The Japanese were just yards away with machine guns, and we were in the hollow. And I tried to throw a hand grenade, but I couldn't unsplice it. We were so weak, I couldn't unsplice the Mills bomb. And I asked my friend Ostrover to do it, but he was older than me, and he was wise. He realized if I throw that hand grenade, the whole Japanese army would be on top of us. So he pocketed it and wouldn't give it back to me. And then we were saved by the fact that Stoker suddenly said, retreat. And we retreated. And that was that. And eventually, after 2 days of fighting in Stanley, we retreated in good order to the fortress of Stanley, where all the guns faced the wrong way. In Singapore, they faced out to sea.
Had you inflicted many casualties on the enemy, do you think, in Stanley?
No, I don't think so. I think quite a few, yes, a few. I think we were heavily on the defensive. We were being shelled. We had no artillery. And I remember sitting in the old Chinese wooden schoolhouse in the Stanley village, and one of our men called Birch, a young chap, was going out to have a crap. And every time he reached the other end of the field, a mortar bomb landed next to him. This was considered to be quite amusing. But we were in a bad situation and outnumbered. And so when we retreated to the fortress, I was so tired, I couldn't even eat. I just collapsed on the floor and slept. And I woke up in the morning and I heard this voice saying, the garrison has surrendered, the governor has surrendered the colony. Would you stack your arms in the middle of the room and throw your ammunition into the fireplace, because they had this fortress, they had fireplaces. Yeah. And they weren't used, obviously, but this was December. So I remember feeling, a lot of people felt a great sense of relief, but I felt a great sense of shame. I mean, it's different psychology. Said realizing that we were prisoners of war, that we'd lost it, and no way could we have won it either. And then again, illusion set in, and a lot of the elder men who had jobs in the utilities or in business or in the gas board were saying things, well, we won't be in for long, the Japs couldn't possibly run this island on their own. They'll need us and they'll release us to run the gas board, the electricity board. I mean, naive thinking about island race was very resourceful, and after all, the Japanese designed and produced one of the best fighter planes of the war, the Zero. And they were very, very competent technologically, and I mean, running a colony. And of course, the Chinese staff all remained in their jobs, most of them remained in their jobs, because otherwise they would have starved. And the Japanese handled the colony, they ran the colony, they depopulated it, they sent people away, they killed a lot of people. And we were then marched from Stanley to a refugee camp called North Point, which had been built for Chinese refugees from the mainland. And that was on the waterfront. And these were early days, so we still had some English rations. You know, we had bully beef occasionally, but we were already prisoners. And the Indians, everybody was in this camp. And after a few days of this camp, we were taken on the Hong Kong ferries to a place called Sham Shui Po, which again was on the waterfront. It was in fact the Jubilee Barracks. It was completely bombed and looted by Chinese looters, bombed by the Japanese Air Force. And these were the barracks of the Japanese. Of the British before the war. And big buildings on the waterfront is where the officers lived. And the huts were where the troops lived. So we really spent the next 3 years and 8 months in these barracks, going out to, because I was young and relatively healthy compared to a lot of people. We all suffered from malnutrition. In fact, the first year was terrible because hundreds of people died from starvation, from epidemics, where the Japanese just were so negligent, they could have saved so many people, they just didn't bother. And
why do you think they were negligent?
Well, they were confident of winning the war. Supplies were needed. They needed supplies. They regarded the Japanese word for prisoner is horio. They regarded prisoners of war with contempt. And that no real man would ever allow himself to be taken as a prisoner of war.
Why was it that you managed to survive personally when so many were dying?
Well, perhaps because I was acclimatized to China, and for instance, and also I was exceedingly clean. We were given 2 cigarettes a day, and I didn't smoke. I was only 18 when I was captured. I didn't smoke till after the war. And people died for a cigarette. I mean, it was the most desirable commodity. I mean, and I used to give mine to a man who worked in the kitchen. And every evening he gave me a bucket of hot water. So I used to come back from a working party covered in mud, dust and everything. And I had a hot bath, effectively. Just take the bucket into the washrooms. And so in the 3 years, I never got a skin disease. Everybody had scabies and things like that. I never got any lice. I kept myself very clean. I had malnutrition. I had beriberi, I had pellagra. I had the heart complaints that come with these diseases. And but I got off lightly, relatively speaking.
Was it the Japanese who gave you 2 cigarettes a day?
Yeah. We had a kind of conversation. Funny enough, I have a poem I wrote about the prisoner of war camp, which was written on paper I used to buy, which had been given kind of a token money to pretend under international law that we'd be paid for our labor. So I used to spare my money on buying a bit of soap and some writing paper. It was very flimsy writing paper, and I was able to write a few things on the writing paper. But the Japanese never looted the Red Cross parcels that we were sent, so we never saw anything. And then things got to a very, very bad point. People started losing their eyesight through the lack of vitamin A, which is cod liver oil and that sort of thing. And people were going blind. There were huts full of people who were completely blind. And I started getting blind. And at that point, the Japanese realized they had a real crisis. They couldn't send blind people out to work. And they went to the warehouses. And they found, among the Red Cross parcels, they found boxes and boxes of cod liver oil caramels. They were little caramels, ridged, and they contained cod liver oil.
You mean sweets?
Yeah, sweets, caramels. But they were of a medicinal value, because that's why they were put in the parcels, because they were for people who lost their sight through malnutrition. And everybody who ate these caramels, incidentally, they were riddled with maggots. And our doctor said, don't worry about the maggots, it's protein. So we ate these, and the results were miraculous. I mean, there were people who never recovered their sight, but they were a minority. Most people, after 5 or 6 caramels, started recovering their sight. So that was a horrible episode. But
had your eyesight started to go?
Oh, yes. Suddenly you saw less and less, because it got dark. And there were huts. And then there was another horrifying disease, which was a kind of a terminal pellagra, basically, a malnutrition, there were two elements in them. One was called strawberry balls. Your balls became raw, completely raw, and flaked, and itched, and hurt. And in conjunction with this, you had what they called, the prisoners called, electric feet. What happened was the fatty layer around the nerves centers in your feet wore away. It was exhausted by hunger and starvation, and the nerves came in contact with the outer tissues. The pain was excruciating. People went mad. People couldn't sleep, and you saw people sitting with their feet in buckets of water under the illusion that the cold water would cool their feet. It had nothing to do with temperature. It was a nervous thing. And that was a real nightmare. And then I walked into a hut of people dying from malnutrition with this condition. And it was like, like something from 19th century Siberian prison. And that could so easily have been cured by vitamin B, but there wasn't any.
Did you know the medical diagnosis at the time?
Our doctors were quite resourceful. They found out. They knew. And in fact, I wrote a sonnet about this. Let's see if I can remember it. Do you want to hear it?
Yes, please.
These did not suffer a dynamic hell. Those screeching shells rent their blind nights asunder. No long bombardment cowed them with a thunder, and at their feet no screaming heroes fell. These were not heroes whom the night ploughed under, but thin men sitting in perpetual pain, rubbing their aching feet with bovine wonder, whimpering in the never-ceasing rain. Now some men shatter like a pane of glass. The lucky die who have no time to think. Their death was not a subtle coup de grace beneath calm stars and non-committed skies, but patient death with Asiatic eyes that kept them waiting at the very brink. It's a sonnet I wrote when I saw these people.
How much did you suffer from these deficiency diseases?
I had sore feet, but not to that degree. See, I was young, and I'd had 18 years of good food, good healthy nourishment behind me. The people of my age didn't suffer as much as older people. I mean, that was one of the facts of life. But I was beginning to get it very badly. And then the Japanese started sending in some vitamins. They gave our doctors vitamins. And we had a diphtheria epidemic, and our doctors asked for a horse, because if they had a horse, they could have produced an anti-diphtheria serum. But the Japanese just weren't interested, and so a couple of hundred people died of diphtheria. It was neglect, it was criminal negligence on the part of the Japanese, and it just reflected their attitude. It mellowed slightly, and also we got acclimatized, we got used to the diet. I mean, to this day, I don't understand how at the age of 20, 21, I worked 12 to 14 hours a day at hard labor, and I mean shifting mountains to make way for a new airport and so on. And I just don't know how we did it. And on 2 bowls of rice a day, a bit of rice gruel, few leaves of vegetable, and now and then as a special treat, a little bit of salted fish or a little tiny bit of pork like that. How we worked, I worked, because I was younger, and to that extent, tougher, more resilient. I remember working for 26 days without a day off, and that was a killing pace.
What was work discipline like?
The Japanese supervisors were there. We would be loading petrol cans. One of the horrible things we did was we had to load 1 ton aerial bombs in the wooden cases on lorries, and then stack them in caves for safety and security. And that was pretty nasty. And one day we were loading these bombs towards the end of the war, and 50 Mustangs came through the gap in the hills to strafe the harbor and drop bombs. And I was loading a lorry, and there were about 10 tons of bombs on it. And one of those bullets had hit that lorry, I wouldn't be here. We all scattered.
Was it possible to slack?
Yes. And ingenious techniques were developed. But on the whole, it wasn't easy. It was possible. And one of the techniques was when we used to... They built a little railway, and we had these wooden carts with a brake, crude brake. We filled them with earth, and then to reclaim land from the sea for the airport. And the idea was, instead of filling this thing, because it went down at set speed, the Japanese didn't have a chance to look inside. We just put a couple of shovels. It slowed down the work. People pissed into petrol. Things like that. People did as much as they could to slow down work. One of the things that kept you going during the war was total hatred of the Japanese. There was a lot to hate there. They were abominable. There were very few of them who were gentlemen or samurais in the glorified sense. And the troops were kind of vulgar, awful rice farmers, jumped up rice farmers. And mind you, they didn't treat their own troops very well either. They had three classes of private, first, second, and third. And the first class of private could be slap a second class private and so on down the hierarchy. So, and also it must be said that they weren't living high off the hog either, because the war was on, the transports were being sunk, supply ships were being sunk, Hong Kong wasn't producing very much food, and they didn't have a great time of it either. But mind you, they were used to their diet, a bowl of rice and a little bit of pickled turnip. But a beef-eating Englishman didn't have a good chance of survival. I wonder if you could take this off. I'm just going to go up. The hatred for the Japanese was incredible. I think a lot of it evaporated after the war, and but certainly it's one thing that was kept us going. I think there's no question at all that if it was possible to break out en masse, and in spite of obvious casualties that have been incurred, heavy casualties, everybody was prepared to do it, because life in prison was pretty insufferable. It was insufferable from day to day, and I would have taken any risk to get out. Unfortunately, the hinterland was Asian, and it was very difficult for a European to hide any Chinese peasant who would give shelter to a prisoner or a European. Would be tortured to death. There's no question at all about it. In fact, there was an attempt made for a mass breakout, and the ringleaders were caught. There's a captain, a wonderful captain of the Royal Scots Regiment. There's a man called Wing Commander Grey, who was the first man, an Australian, who flew from Melbourne to London. And they were executed because they were implicated in an attempt to organize a plan for a massive breakout. And, of course, in our small ways, anything we could do to slow down the work or to sabotage, one did. There's not much one could do.
Did the Japanese have any redeeming features?
You had acts of kindness by individual Japanese who'd share their food with you or give you a cigarette, I mean, for people who smoked. But... And I don't think, I think that towards the end of the war, the people who ran our concentration camp, one of them committed harakiri, were honorable people, you know, within the parameters of their job. There was a sergeant major who was a magnificent looking man, was very kind and very good. The old fat commandant was hung. And there was a Canadian Japanese who lived in Canada, spoke with a heavy Canadian accent, and he lived in some very rough part of the Yukon or somewhere, where obviously he was a corn yellow bastard every day of his life, and he had a passionate hate for Europeans, and he was a monster. And he was executed after the war in Hong Kong. He was hung. But you know, having lived in Asia all my life, though I hated them for what they were doing to us, and what they were doing to the Chinese was even worse, I understood what motivated them, and I understood their psychology, which helped me personally a little bit. For instance, I was once hit by a Japanese, and he only hit me once because I looked at him straight in the eyes, and I didn't try to dodge the blow, and he knew that I was looking at him, and I was quite prepared to accept a second and third blow, and I had never stopped looking at his eyes. That's very Asian. He understood that, so his hand wavered. There was no second blow. On the other hand, the same day, there was a young chap who I knew, who was in the Peace Corps, the Regular Army Peace Corps, and he tried to make a run for it. The Japanese struck him, and he got a terrible beating as a result. You have to understand their psychology.
Why do they expect you to look you in the eye?
Well, because it suggests that you will accept the punishment without loss of your dignity. And dignity is very important to Japanese.
Was that the only time you were hit?
It was not the only time. Towards the end of the war, we were working on the railway line, and a Japanese came and hit me without any reason at all. And at that time, we knew the war was ending. And I picked up a sleeper, and I hit him with it. And instead of being bayoneted, the other Japanese sentries rushed and separated us as if there was a pub fight, and calmed me down and calmed him down, you know. But that was towards the end of the war, where they knew the writing was at all. Oh yes, so there was one episode. We were scything the grass at what is now Kaitak Airport, which we were reclaiming, building it, lengthening it. And we were squatting like Chinese coolies, you know, scything the grass, and with three or four friends, and we were laughing at some joke. Well, the Japanese sentry thought we were laughing at him. He crept up behind me and he swung his rifle like a baseball bat and caught me in the lower back, and I just toppled over and couldn't get up for about half an hour. And the injury didn't catch up with me until 25 years later. It suddenly appeared on the air, on the X-rays. But that was a terrible blow. And but I was young, again, healed, and it never bothered me for years, until much later in life. But these are the only examples of violence I knew. But the whole business of keeping 9,000 men in the prison of war camp. We had one great advantage over other prisoners of war camp. In Hong Kong, because Hong Kong was Chinese, part of China, and the Japanese were kind of softened by the climate of Hong Kong, which they weren't in other parts of the Pacific Theater. They allowed us to run our own camp. In other words, they allowed us to have our own administration. They wanted us to appoint a friendly commandant on our side, and he was the liaison man. But that was a great advantage. They weren't interfering in our everyday affairs. We ran our own camp.
What did Hong Kong's being part of China have to do with allowing you to run the camp yourself?
Well, no, I just think that the conditions for the prisoners in Hong Kong was pretty bad. But compared to Changi in Singapore, the Burma Railway, etc., they were much better. And I ascribe this to the fact that Hong Kong was a more kind of mild, mellow place, with a smell of a great smell of tolerance in the air. And the Japanese behaved differently in Hong Kong towards prisoners than they did elsewhere. We had no atrocities. People not beaten to death. They were not tied to stakes and left out broiling in the sun. They were relatively to the other prison camps. We had an easier time.
Did the Japanese speak to you about the progress of the war and what they expected?
Oh, they just made arrogant remarks that they're going to win the war and etc. etc. It wasn't until much later that you suddenly realized that doubts were beginning to set in, and we did get news through, and I think this was because somebody was operating a crystal set. Now, this is punishment by death if it was found out. I think that there would have been no appeal. But this little crystal set went on working. So, to give you an example, we had news of all the battles, naval battles. But the most important bit of news was, the whole camp virtually celebrated, was when we heard about Stalingrad. And that The news were very discreetly disseminated from hut to hut by word of mouth.